Well,
this is the tape. The Stokely Carmichael, Isabel Blair, Lucy Thornton, and Jean Wheeler, Howard University, March 3rd.
4th.
March
3rd.
Okay. Mr. Blair, you were in the first sit-ins in Greensboro, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell something about the origin of those sit-ins, how they were arranged beforehand, planned?
Well,
how did it come about?
The sit-ins originated, the idea originated with my roommate, Joseph McNeil. We were all freshmen at A&T College. And one day, Joe...
You said began the idea with your roommate. His name is what?
Oh, his name is Joseph McNeil.
Joseph McNeil.
Yeah. Right now, he's a second lieutenant in the Air Force in Texas. But... the idea came about one day when Joe came into the room, and he had a disturbed look on his face, and I asked him what was wrong with him. And he told me he had just come from, I think, the Greyhound bus station in Greensboro, and he asked to get served there at the lunch counter, and he was refused. So I told him, I said, well, you know how things are. You know how segregation is. It's been here all the time. Nothing we can do about it.
Was he from the South, or was he from
Well, he was from the South. He was from Wilmington, North Carolina. He graduated, he went to high school there. He graduated from Wilson High School. And I asked him, well, what can we do? And he said, well, we ought to have something like a boycott. And I said, a boycott? And he said, yes, we should go in and sit down at the lunch counter. And he named Woolworths. And he said, ask for service, and if they refuse us, then we continue to sit there, and if we throw it in jail, we'll go to jail. And then we ask the people not to buy the place. So, Eddie Cadman, you should meet him.
And then what happened?
Well, we told our friends, David Richmond, who's from Greensboro, and Franklin McCain, who's from Washington, but he went to high school with us at Adela High School, right, where we went to school, David and I. And they liked the idea. So in the ensuing week, which followed the day I talked with Joe, we talked about our plans, things about the rights of man, and how we felt, you know, about being Negroes, and what rights we felt should be ours. And finally, on January 31st, 1969, before we went down, Joe came into the room. And he asked us, were we ready to go? And, well, we were, at first I thought he was kidding, so were the rest of us. So Frank, who's the largest guy in the group, said, are you guys chicken or something? And we said, no, we're not chicken. He said, well, we're going tomorrow down Woolworth to sit in. I said, okay, we're going like that. And we told a local merchant there, Ralph John, he's worked with NACP. He's always liked to go behind ideas, maybe revolutionary ideas, but most of the conservatives in the NACP at the time didn't like him because they felt he was too much of a radical. So when we told him what we were going to do, he decided he would help us. We went by and we talked to him about the idea, and he said, well, he would give us money to buy articles downtown of Woolworth. And after we set in, he said he would contact reporters and the police department and everything like that. So the scene was set, and around 4:15, February 1st, 1960, we went downtown, and we purchased articles at the merchandise counter at Woolworth, and then we proceeded toward the lunch counter, and we sat down and we asked for service. So that's how the idea started.
Did this have any relation to the old March on Washington movement? It's theorizing.
Well,
had you all read about that?
Well, no, we had not read about any of the previous movements.
Because that was a long time ago. That was back in 1941.
Yes. I asked Joe where did he get the idea from, and he told me he got the idea from a boycott which took place in Wilmington, I think, in 1959 when he was a senior in high school there. He said they had a talent show at the school, in Wilmington, not at the school, and it was sponsored by a local soda pop firm. I think it was Pepsico or Coca-Cola. And, well, they felt that the Negroes, the prizes were given to all the whites, and the Negroes didn't receive any prizes at all. So they felt there was some discrimination there. And they protested by not buying the sodas from the soda firm and soda pop firm, and the soda pop firm reviewed his policies, and they decided they would give a talent show over again, and they gave out prizes to Negroes after that. So this is where Cho said he got the idea from. So I didn't hear of any previous movement. Of course, the only one that we knew about was Martin Luther King's movement.
Yes.
And, you know, in Birmingham. I mean, in Montgomery. But otherwise than that, it's the only movies we knew about.
Have you read about the Washington, the March on Washington movement since then? The old one? 20 years
well,
ago?
I read about it. I read about it this summer. And this was through the Afro magazine, the Afro newspaper. Or it was through, it was through one of the national weekly magazines.
Now, CORE was the organization that came in to back you up, wasn't it?
Well, we had offers, I think it was on the second day of our demonstrations. We called in for the NAACP, but CORE came down first. Dr. Simpkins, who was president of NAACP at the time, called in...
The local president
of NAACP at the time, of Greenberg, called in CORE, Gordon Carey. And Mr. Carey came down. He offered his assistance to our student executive committee for justice. This was a student group which spearheaded the movement. And at the time, we told them we didn't want any outside organizations coming in because of what the town folk might say, that the movement was taken over by outside people. So we thanked him very much for his aid, but we declined to take it. And the next day, Herbert Wright, who was then the youth secretary of the NAACP, came down, but he couldn't offer too much in assistance. He only gave us more support, like good luck, we're with you, and so forth. But Gordon Carey, as we understood, had experience, and CORE had experience in sit-in and so forth. So we passed up both.
Now, that some of the reports on that, you know, are a little different from this account. Some of them said that CORE came in immediately, you see, and was accepted.
Some of
the accounts of it in print say that, you see.
Well, from being there at the meeting the night that Mr. Curry came down, this was...
Because you were there.
I was there, and our student executive committee for justice went on record for and has declined his help to offer. We thank him very much, but we told him we wanted to remain, as one student said, we appreciate your aid, but we would like for it to remain a student movement at the time. And if we need your help, we will call him. And he thanked us, and he went on to Durham, I believe, the next day.
Now, this is a rather important point in one way, not a major way, but some of the printed accounts say this, and that's my memory tricks me, that the appeal was made, by your group to... Mr. Simpkins, is that right?
Yes,
Mr. Simpkins.
Dr.
Simpkins, I mean. And instead of going to the NAACP, as might have been expected, he called in CORE because he assumed that NAACP would be too legalistic and not militant enough. That's the interpretation that's given in print sometimes.
This is, to a certain extent, this is true. I think the Greenberg chapter in NAACP was sort of written on the blacklist by a national office after Dr. Simpkins did this. And I remember the 1960 convention that I went to. Greensboro was the last city we recognized before the sit-in. Oklahoma City, I understand, I think this is where young lady Barbara Posey is now, that was given recognition for starting the sit-in. We didn't know anything about this in Oklahoma because, well, when we were in high school, I think it took place when we were in high school, so we were told. But 58. Well, we found out later on as we started the movement that Oklahoma had similar demonstrations like this, and we got CORE information. But we found out then that these demonstrations, even though they were NAACP groups, were organized by CORE, you see.
The earlier ones, you mean?
Yeah, in Oklahoma. But we didn't know anything about this at the time. And so the NAACP, as we call it, tried to write in this minutes at this convention that the demonstrations were spontaneous and that they were started back in 1958. The organization at the time didn't want to give credit to the Greensboro movement.
Which organization now? NAACP?
Yeah, this was NAACP. They wanted to give credit.
It's a national
organization. Yes, national organization. And I think one reason was the cause was of Dr. Simpkin's actions and of our actions, because when we left the Woolworth store on February the 1st, 1960, we were asked by a reporter from the Greensboro Record, were we sent there by NAACP? And we told the reporter no. Although some of us had been proud members of the NAACP when we were in high school. But at the time, none of us were members of the NAACP.
But you had repudiated both organizations as far as their help was concerned.
Yes, that's true.
You had refused both with thanks.
That's true. We wanted to sort of destroy the old idea that Negroes have to be told everything to do by the NAACP or CORE. It wasn't that we had disrespect for the groups, because we respected them very much. But it was just that the idea that college students coming downtown, sitting in, asking service, couldn't do these things unless they were told to do it by somebody else.
That this was not motivated, the sitting itself was not motivated by a notion, criticism of the NAACP's previous role. Is that right?
Well, partially yes and partially no. One of the things that we...
You said partially yes and partially no about the attitude toward the NAACP.
Yes, from this standpoint, when we talked about doing something to remove segregation in West Carolina and Greensboro, we mentioned the fact that the present methods, you know, the legal methods, which had been used by groups like the NAACP, while it was a good method and a lasting method to be put on the books so forth as law was concerned, it was not a good method when it came to immediate removal of discrimination. And we wanted to have a personal involvement in removing discrimination, which we felt the NAACP wouldn't go along with. And if they did, the national office would take about 2 or 3 months before it gave us approval. And by that time, the idea will be lost, as many ideas of this nature were probably lost beforehand.
I see.
And no, we didn't take a disrespectful attitude toward the NAACP. We realized that it has been the forerunner of the civil rights movement for a long time. And we respect the organization very much for what it has done. But we felt that it was time for new action to be taken in the South. You see, to us, it appeared that it was something like the hierarchy, maybe like the Catholic Church, and no offense to Catholics in there, you know, in Italy, giving out all the orders, you know, and none of its affiliates in other countries will make a move until maybe their ideas or suggestions or their policies were approved by the head office in Italy, and that in the Vatican City. And so we felt the NAA was organized on the same basis. And we felt that many times Negroes felt discouraged in the South because it took too long for the NAA or the NAACP to make up its mind what it was going to do.
Here's a remark attributed to Mr. Wilkins. They being SNCC, CORE, furnished the noise, but the NAACP pays the bills, as bail, legal costs, and so forth, of CORE, SNCC, SCLC. Here today and gone tomorrow. There's only one organization that can handle a long, sustained fight.
Well, that doesn't mean the NAACP.
That's attributed to the NAACP.
Well, I think at the time Mr. Wilkins made his speech, it was probably due to the reason that the NAACP was probably seeking membership funds. Now, I really don't think Mr. Wilkins is sincere about what he says, because I think as a result of groups like SNCC, SCLC, CORE, and other groups working in the South, the NAACP is getting many of its funds to fight the legal battle. Not taking anything away from the NAACP, I think it's doing a good job, a very good job, and will continue to do so.
But the movement since 1960 has switched from a legal courtroom battle to where you deal with conformity of men on the basis of law to a battle between men when it comes to personal consciousness in regard to segregation. Now, I think this is the basis of the present movement now.
Now, not to nag at this question.
Yeah.
But you don't mean to imply, do you, that the matter of direct action, nonviolent direct action, should supplant the continued effort to set up the legal framework and the legal philosophy should underlie even the direct action?
Well, no. I'm not implying that that direct nonviolent action should supplant the legal method and the legal means of eradicating segregation. I think while it is good to establish laws on the books, one of the main problems that we have been having now, that we have many laws on the books in regard to segregation and discrimination in schools and so forth, is that we're having a problem of getting the people to accept these laws. And this is where I think direct nonviolent action comes into play, where we as the oppressed actually begin to practice what these laws say, no discrimination.
That
so is, we're seeking equal equality.
That is used, the direct action then is a way of implementing the law. Is that the
yes,
view?
Yes. Yes,
and not a way of supplanting the
not,
law
not
as
a way
the
of,
method of achieving yes, the desired ends.
Yes, I think you're right that it is a direct nonviolent action is a means of implementing the law and
this
carrying
is not,
it out.
This is not always what is said, of course.
Well,
sometimes
maybe.
But sometimes it's said, you know, differently.
We
have had enough of the law, but now this.
Yes, uh-huh. I think you can't separate the two. You need both. But I am in disagreement with those who feel that that the legal method is the only answer, and I'm disagreeing with those who feel that the nonviolent method is the only answer. I think you can still use it too. But where the conflict comes in is where one group feels that the other group is of no use to the movement any further.
Got it. That is this quotation from Mr. Wilkins, you say, Mr. Carmichael, is for the Time magazine story.
Yeah.
The cover story.
On the New York Times, right. I think that's an unfair statement.
Unfair to him or unfair on his part?
Unfair on his part. I don't think that he should have made a statement like that at all.
Now, while I agree with Mr. Wilkins that the NAACP has been the organization that's been there since 1911, as the case may be, and it has been fighting, has been doing, I don't think that he's completely correct when he says that the other groups have come by here, come by night. I think he felt that the NAA was attacked by a lot of other groups for being conservative, and he felt that the way to fight the attack was to make this statement, putting the other groups on the defensive. My personal feeling was that it backfired.
Let's change the subject a bit. Mr. Blair, how would you describe first the so-called, quote, new Negro? How would you distinguish this character from previous characters? Or do you believe in this definition, this phrase covers anything?
Well, to a certain extent, I don't think there is anything as a Negro. I think what it is that more people now in mass are adopting the ideas of direct action, and more members of the Negro race, as well as many whites, are now seeking or now want to know more about the history of the Negro and the part he's had to play in America. And this new idea of militancy, as I said, is being adopted by more people in mass numbers. There have been many people before us
such as Du Bois and Robeson and Walter White and Roy Wilkins, James Weldon Johnson, and so forth, who have been what they call radical Negroes, or new Negroes, so to speak. But they were only in small number. But now, since 1960, and since King's movement in Montgomery, there are more people in mass numbers who are accepting these ideas and views that we must take we must do something personally to remove segregation. And so I say, while the idea of the new Negro is still with us, in many respects, the idea is not a new one. It's something that existed all the time.
The very phrase "new Negro" dates back to the 20s. That whole group of the 20s, group that Langston Hughes was associated with, the word was applied, the phrase was applied to that group.
That group.
That's a long time ago now, 40 years ago.
Can I catch you?
This would raise another question, though. You say mass movement. Has SNCC or COA or NAACP or any other organization actually worked in mass terms? Hasn't it been a matter of rather specialized leadership? Rather than a spontaneous movement from the Negro masses, a movement within leadership groups or potential leadership groups.
To a certain extent, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I can't speak very much for it, but I still maybe Stokely can give more information about it. But from my observation, it is in primary composed of college students and high school students who want to do something about eradicating segregation. A core is made up. Basically, the majority of core members are college students and high school students. The NAACP's organization is made up mostly of professional people, and so the Urban League also is made up of professional people. But I feel that the movement now, since 1960, has become one of mass numbers. Since 1960 is mostly college students.
Yes.
But since then, and especially since 1963, the movement has become one in which you have adults involved. People who want to register to vote, people who have jobs, people who are seeking all these things that we've been talking about, better job employment, release from police brutality, and so forth.
Two things like the registration drives and the boycotts, including the bus boycott, have moved toward a mass base. Is that it?
That's right. Yes,
sir. I'm not sure. Stokely Carmichael.
Yes, Mr. Carmichael.
I would assume that if we start with the Montgomery movement, that had a mass movement and that everybody boycotted it. But that was a passive action. They just didn't take the bus. It wasn't anything as to going out in the street. And I'd say that the first mass movement, the new wave since 1960, we've had would be Albany, Georgia, where you had 700 people arrested from the town. And it was for demonstrations against segregation, open facilities. And it was, in that case, also the part of all the indigenes at that town walking up and down the streets. Since then, we've had Cambridge, we've had Danville, we've had Birmingham, we've had Greenwood and Jackson, Mississippi. And it has become, since then, a mass movement on that sense. Now, there are a few professional agitators, and I don't have qualms about using the word agitators at all, who do agitate. But once the movement gets going, in most cases now, it's aimed at a mass movement. If you go back to 61, the Freedom Rides, for example, it wasn't even, when we were arrested, we just went into jail. Well, we want to get students into jail. But now, a number of SNCC people came out and decided to start agitation in Jackson to get Jackson people to go to jail. And they got 50 people from Jackson, Mississippi to go to jail. That was a big step up. And from then started the whole thing about mass movement in jail.
This is from you boys. The Negro group has long been internally divided by dilemmas as to whether its striving should be aimed at strengthening the inner culture and group bonds for intrinsic progress or offensive power, or whether it should seek escape whenever possible into the surrounding culture. Decision in this matter has been largely determined by outer compulsions rather than inner plan to this point. In other words, over and over again in Du Bois' writings and the writings of other people, we find this notion of a fundamental split in intention, actually divided desires to be associated with the Negro tradition, even with the African mystique, on one hand, to preserve the racial integrity, on the other hand, to move into an integrated situation and adopt the Western European American cultural values, with perhaps a loss of even racial identity in the end. Now, for some people, this is clearly, as with you boys, a problem. For others, it's not at all. How would we react to that? Ms. Thornton, do you want to say anything on that point?
Yes, my first reaction, of course, would be thinking of Socrates, know thyself. I would think that the problem or the dilemma which Mr. Du Bois speaks of is one which is very common to Negro Americans today, because we do face the problem of amalgamation into the whole of American society or into the whole of American life, being American per se, or being what I would like to term Negro Americans or Black Americans, I guess is even a better way of putting it. And I think that we as Black men have an obligation to, as I've said before, know ourselves as Black men, be proud of what we are, and contribute to America what we could actually offer to this culture. I believe that there is something unique which the Black man can offer to this melting pot, insofar that there is still a melting pot. I know that more and more today Americans are tending towards thinking of themselves as some entity which is now, I guess, some figure like the Joneses, or there's some idea set up as to what an American man or American woman is. And I think that because this has been the tendency in America, it does not exclude what other racial minorities or ethnic groups could, in fact, add to our culture to make it what America has always been, in fact, known to the world for.
Mr. Carmichael, how do you feel about this? Do you recognize a problem here, or do you just say the problem doesn't exist for you, as many people say about yourself?
Well, it sort of exists. I don't go to the extreme as Lucy. Professor Herskowitz, in his book, The Myth of the Negro Past, tried to show that Negroes in America had some connection with African ritualists and African culture. Professor Frazier and Professor Parks, University of Chicago, as far as I'm concerned, clearly answered him and showed him that he was just all wrong on that issue.
And the culture, the Negro is totally of the American culture.
Totally of the American culture. And that makes the Negro a unique specimen in America, because he is the only one who is totally American. And I forget the name of it, there's a psychologist out of the University of Chicago who contends he's Jewish, and he was in one of the camps in Germany, and he wrote a book, I forgot the name of it also, in which he showed that people who are oppressed usually take on all the superficial and all the mannerisms of the oppressors. This, for instance, would be a classic example of Frazier's Black Bourgeoisie. And when the oppressed people take on all the characteristics of the oppressed, they exaggerate. Now, it's my feeling that as far as the movement has developed this far, it's not a revolution, it's not even a reform. All it has been is the Negroes have been trying to get into the established system as it is now. Let us get into your jobs, let us get into your restaurants, let us get into the housing neighborhoods, let us get into your schools. We just want to get into it. And that's the way it's been so far, and that's a fact.
Now, there are some people, James Baldwin among them, who will say, in part at least, that the Negro is prepared to offer a fundamental criticism of middle-class American values.
Oh, Baldwin is right, and he's not right. The Negro who he speaks about is not the Negro whom the white press allows to speak, or the white mass communication allows to speak. The Negro who speaks is the one who says, yes, I am wearing a tie and a suit, I'm clean, I've been to a college in the South, and I'm a college professor in the South, or I'm a Negro lawyer or a Negro doctor, and my accent is clear, my English is superb, and I have a Cadillac in my car, and what else can you expect of me? Now, that's not the Negro that Baldwin is talking about. The Negro that Baldwin is talking about is the one who's down on the bottom, who's nothing to offer. And in that sense, then you really have integration, because when you talk about integration, you talk about bringing two things together. You know, I have my chitlins, I have my wine on Friday night, I'll come in your house, you eat some of my fried chicken, and I'll eat some of your a la carte, whatever it is. But as far as it's seen now, it's just the Negroes just fighting to get into something. And it's like you're giving up everything. You're giving up your jazz, you're giving up your soul music, your Ray Charles, or whatever, as we say, the nitty-gritty, to get into this.
Now, we spoke earlier today, you and I, of Essien Udem. Essien Udem.
Right,
the
right.
Black, the author of Black Nationalism. Right. He makes the point, if I remember the book correctly, that even the separatists and the black nationalists, like the black Muslims, are actually a concealed way, perhaps unconsciously, moving toward a full acceptance of American middle class values. This provides a conduit, a backstairs ladder to the achievement of the middle class values, even though they are not specified by that group.
I agree with that.
That's a fair
diagnosis, because Negroes in America have not presented any other alternative. Let's say the Italians were having trouble, and the Italians would have some home culture to fall back on. We have no home culture to fall back on. None at all.
Now, of course, some Negroes would not agree with you.
Of course they would not, but I would ask them for their home culture. What have we got? We have a subculture within a main culture, and the main culture is so suppressed that I bet you if you went south and asked a Negro girl or a Negro boy to draw a picture of a man on the board, they would inevitably draw the picture of a white man or a white woman with features of a white man or a white woman.
The test that I know of, at least, has been run at Negro schools in the South to associate qualities with color. The test, I originally saw it a long time ago, Dr. Johnson, in one of his books, he gave the results of this. This is back in the 30s. It bore this out, what you're saying, bore it out.
Recently, for instance, they did a test, some psychologists, I think it was the Clockhorns, where they had Negro dolls and white dolls. And they would have Negro girls come and pick which doll was prettiest. And inevitably, they picked the white doll.
And of course, you know why.
This is Gene Bell. This is not Gene Wheeler.
Hi.
Come on, how are you? How are you? Lucy told me hands up. Are you ready?
Yes, I met you before.
What about that topic for you? Is that a real question to you or a false question?
Well, it poses as a real question because many of us in the movement there are going through this experience. Whether we're going through these experiences, whether we should adopt the full values of a white middle class society, or whether we should develop within ourselves and through this thing we call as the movement, an idea or an image of what we like to think of as being ourselves, being accepted as Negroes, not as whites. I know many times I am confronted with this problem of whether I should adopt the values of a middle class American society or whether I should be myself as a Negro. I don't think all values, all the white middle class values are good for Negroes at this point.
Or for white people.
Or for white people. Now, such things as many instances are given a monetary value for all things. I don't think that we should accept this value because while this is a capitalist society we live in, Negroes, who are in many instances on the bottom of the income bracket, cannot accept the idea, cannot make it on maybe wearing a $100 suit down the street every day or driving the Cadillac. We just don't have the economic ability to do these things. So I think, I don't think integration is the best thing for us. And desegregation is good. We already have interracial marriage. You can look around and you can see Negroes of many different complexions. I do feel that we as a group of people should try to develop more unity among ourselves. And I feel this is one of the things that the movement is doing, that the civil rights movement is doing. Many young people now are beginning to feel proud to be black. There still is, I should say, a great extent that the Negroes try to mimic whites. They use straightened combs, they process their hair, they imitate everything white American white society does. But I hope to see how this movement and a realization of the fact that the Negroes will recognize the fact that once and for all that they're Negroes, that we're black, and that we can do it by changing being black, and that there's some values and many things that we can contribute to American society, which is good, and that there are already many values and contributions that we have made to American society. I hope this is something that will be brought out.
If you're not going on to the next question, I'd like
please respond. Go ahead.
Amused in many instances listening to you, Stokely, of course, because I'm very much aware, of course, of the people who, even within my own family, for example, who would very strongly say that we're so much American until the European background or the English background, which other men can claim when they say, yes, we are white Anglo-Saxon American. So can so many Negroes, to a certain extent, stand in America and say the same thing. But, of course, they've had a problem which has stuck with them throughout. They were black men, after all, in spite of this development. Yes, we have had imposed upon us a white man's society, but we have continued throughout that black men, even though there might have been a certain amount of mutation over into the other side, and gotten a certain amount of passing, we've gotten a certain amount of acceptance, we've got all of this. But the Negro or the black man in this country still has to know and accept and be proud of himself as a black man and have America to accept him as the same. Because there's an example which I used to like to look at when I was in college. The black man can find himself lost in the white man's America. In other words, he can do everything under the sun which would make him ordinary A1 American man. And he thinks that he's been accepted not only by Negroes, but over in the larger society as just another American. He's reached the top of the ladder. He's become the peace leader for the world. He's with the UN. He's a great man in everybody's book, but it's going to come back to him over and over, and as much as he wants to abandon the idea that I'm a member of a minority, I'm just another black man, when he gets to the top of it all, there's going to be somebody who's in that majority, white and probably not worth 1/90th of what he's worth, who's going to step on his toes and spit in his face and say, look, you're still black. And that really... That really, I guess, brings home the message to him that he is, yes, he's an American, very much American, probably more American than the person who's just said to him, but keep in mind, you're American, yes, but a black American, and you have a place, you know.
Stokely Carmichael. You see, I agree with you, Lucy, but I think the whole thinking just shows precisely what I was saying, Now, number one, the whole question here that you're posing is whether or not white people are going to accept black people. See, you know, I'm not sure. You know, the question isn't whether or not they're going to accept me. I just have to decide whether or not I want to accept them. Now, that's an important point. The whole development is that because we don't have a culture, you know, what do we can sit down and throw certain in-jokes, like for instance, we can say nitty-gritty and stuff like that, and lose a few white people, and it's getting nowadays we can't even lose them when we talk. And we can eat chitlins, and Mr. Penhorn probably knows more about chitlins than we do. So where's our culture? Jazz, we can listen to Ray Charles, but where is it? It's all so bound up in the American system. All our aspirations are typically American. We are more American than the American. And that's a fact, whether or not we like it or not. Whether or not we like it or not, it's still a fact. Yeah. And you can't prove contrary to that.
Let me ask another question related to this, or say something, what it's worth. I was talking a few weeks ago to a very able lawyer in a southern city. He's a northern trained, one of the better northern university law schools, practicing in the south now, man of middle age. He said, I have in late years had to school myself when reading English literature or simply listening to sermons in many aspects of life to refuse the metaphorical thinking that's implicit in that literature and in that way of life. He said, I live in a world where the metaphors are insults to me. Black versus white. Values, sin versus virtue. Light, wisdom, intelligence, darkness, ignorance. But this whole world of metaphor I'm living in, that I've just got to school myself to invert them. Now, what's interesting here is that he feels it so keenly. He is schooling himself to invert them every time he hears encounters this in his reading of literature or in any common speech or in a sermon anywhere. he's speaking very honestly and fully about his views, you see, about the white society in which he is living.
That's
strikes me as extreme.
Well, I can say this about it. We do, in fact, live in times when black men can, in fact, be proud to be black men. That is, black Americans. I'm sure the times which Stokely spoke of when he spoke of our beginnings and when he spoke of what Negroes historically have been in America and why they are so terribly American. I guess part of it being also that in white America, we knew what standards represented what is in fact American, and usually they were contrary to what is in fact black or what is in fact the black man. So that the black man had to usually think in terms of the white doll with all of the Caucasian features as in fact being beautiful. Anything separate and apart from that or anything that smacked of black or Negro just happened not to be too kosher. But today at least, a black man can stand with his head erect and say, you know, I am a black man and I expect to be accepted for what I am. Black is not inferior. I mean, we've had all of the scientific theories. We've had these disputes. They've been set to rest. The Negro, like any other man, has the capacity, the ability, and he, in fact, deserves to be accepted. He's not something that looks on from the back door at what happens in the big house and, you know, can say, that's what I want to be one day, including I want to be white. Sense. This is what some of the reactions, I mean, can be in a society where being what you is not acceptable.
Well, coming with
yes, you, Mr. Blair.
Ethel Blair, coming with what you're saying, Lucy, I agree with you to a certain extent. And while many people, most of the newspapers are criticizing groups like the black Muslims, I see the Muslims as having some good points about their organization. Now, I don't agree with them on the bit about separation, but I do like some of the things that they're doing. I see nothing wrong with having another faith. I think what the Muslims are trying to do is use a religion as a means of binding the people together. And
While the NAA and other groups are using the demonstrations and so forth as a means of binding people and building unity, they're using this Islam religion as a means of binding people together. And so forth as the criminals are concerned, or juvenile delinquents are concerned among the members of the black Muslims, it has been proven that most of their members, that there's a great decline among juvenile delinquency among those people who are Muslims.
That they have actually redeemed a great many people.
They have redeemed a great many people. So I think it's not all bad as a part of this organization. I think it's a part of this organization. I think if we look at it from an objective point of view, there are some good things which I think if American society will look at, it could be useful towards straightening out some of the ills that we're facing today.
You mean for whites as well as Negroes?
Whites as well as Negroes.
The question of learning, of achieving a sense of self-acceptance and of identity that would prevent the man in the gutter from his doom, saving from his doom.
Yeah, I think this is, see, when I was coming up in school, everything that I saw was of the middle class value. Even in our schools now, most of the predominant Negro schools or segregated schools where I come from in the South, Negro students are taught by middle-class people. Most of these students, the majority of them, come from low-income families. And they're taught to accept the ways of the middle class. So many of these kids can't strain out to this. And so, in many respects, I was told by some of my instructors, well, I have mine, you have yours to get. This is the attitude that many of the Negro students in the South come up with. And so, many of them not coming from these homes, they can't help but they're dirty when they come to school. And so what happens, they automatically reject and fall out of school because they say, I never can be up to these standards. And I think what we really need among ourselves as Negroes is a sense of racial pride. Not so much of racism, but a sense of accepting who we are and what we are and the roles that we have to play in our society, and not an inferior role.
Let me ask a question related to that. Is it possible to argue that the Southerner, whoever the Southerner is, will say the segregationist, who's short of a fanatic in it?
Not a good definition of Southern, if I could interrupt, since I also call myself Southern.
Yes, all right. I'm trying to
use that definition at
all. All right, no, newspaper definition, you see.
Man, okay.
You know that.
Oh, you're a Southern Belle.
Well, our Southern segregationist, he thinks he's defending. He says the way of life, the Southern way of life, you see, all of this. But he's saying those things. He is trying to defend a cultural identity. In other words, a self. He's got it mixed up with his view of a whole package of things, including segregation. Now, if he doesn't, if he could be led to see that his identity does not depend on segregation, his cultural identity, then the whole pattern might change for it. Does that make any sense? I'm not stating that well, but you see what I mean? He feels defensive. The white Southerner feels defensive. He feels his culture is being attacked. His identity is being attacked. He's being robbed of his identity, his history. And he has his notion, the unlettered man, or poorly lettered one, or unreflected one, sees segregation as part of his tradition and part of his identity. Necessary thing for the identity.
Yeah, Stokely Carmichael, right? Can you say something?
You can go on.
The whole statement is very, very ironic. Because if the white Southerner knew anything about his history, number one, he would know that after Reconstruction, there was not official segregation, state law-backed segregation. That the Negroes and whites went to school together because the South at that time just received free school.
And the Civil War generation thought segregation was preposterous.
They certainly did. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come until Mississippi started instituting the black codes.
So that his whole tradition, he talks about tradition, he talks about institution. You can change institutions, but you can't change people. His whole feelings were molded by institutions.
A generation back.
A generation back. So that when he tells me now that institutions, you can change the laws, but you can't change the people, he evidently doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
I agree with that, if I could. Lucy Thornton here. Non-recognition of the existence of the black man in the South is quite an interesting thing for the Southerner, because, as Stokely has said, there has been a time when
quite
he
so not me now.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, let me get this. White Southerner. Okay. Although, by the way, few Negroes would say they're Southern. So that's, you know,
I don't know.
Very few who would dare say they're Southerners. And this non-recognition of the black man, I would agree with Stokely that there has been a time when, in fact, the white man has recognized the black man's existence. And now, all of a sudden, he wants to erase from his mind. He thinks this is something that he's forced by law to put up with, or he's something to segregate out of his society, to keep out altogether. I think that it would be in the mind of the new Southerner, or the person who's interested in bringing the South out of what it has in fact gotten itself down into, that is, non-recognition of a good part of its society, and this non-recognition bringing with it the running away from the South. Not, I don't mean running away as such, but the moving away from the South of a good part of the population, that is, the black man too. I think more and more the new Southerner will realize the black man has a place there in the South, and that the black man can, in fact, help to make the South a great South again. In other words, they'll have to recognize that more than just the brawn and the labor of the black man, which made what they call the old South great, they've got to recognize that this black man can stand side by side by them, education and everything else, and make the South what it ought to be today.
Easy
Mr.
on
Blair?
Oh, easy on Blair. I was talking about Lucy and Sophie is saying.
I agree with everything they say, especially probably when Lucy said about many people fearing to be called Southerners. I think what is happening is that as
we were talking about some illusions that white Southerners have about their history. The problem about delusions among Negroes, according to some writers, this being Arnold Rose, the Mid-Arts collaborator, I'm quoting from, the whole tendency of the Negro history movement, not as history, but as used as propaganda, is to encourage the average Negro to escape reality, the actual achievements and the actual failures of the present. Although the movement consciously tends to build race pride, it also may cause Negro unconsciously to recognize that group pride is built partly on delusion, and therefore may result in a devaluation of themselves for being forced to resort to self-deception concerning their own history. Does that make any sense to anybody here?
I don't think so.
I think it does in a way.
Ms.
Well, since probably not in the way that you mean, does it make sense?
I'm not interpreting it. I'm saying, does it make sense to you?
Although some of the things which historians, Negro historians, and other writers have said about the Negro's past or its history might be based upon some delusion. I think that looking at most of what is in fact said about the Negro's past, as far as the glory of it is concerned, has contained very, very little delusion. And I think that the view which the Negro today gets of his past contains so little of what is in fact the
excuse me, we may have killed the mic. kill the last few sentences and resume here. Miss Thornton, will you speak again about the matter of delusion and Negro history, or the possibility of delusion in the Negro history movement?
Yes, I think that the Negro has heard so little, which, in fact, as so little from the Negro historian, which is in fact padding, or which is in fact delusion, as compared to what the white American has in fact heard of his heritage and his background and his history. For example, take any Southern school in the United States and take the history book that we in fact read in the Southern school. I'm a Virginian myself.
I know, you told me that months ago.
I know the history that we in fact have in school. I know what our legislatures, I know what the white Southerner wants and feels that we should in fact know and believe about history. I also know that my brother is now in teaching college history in the South. And I know also efforts on the part of people who are supposed to be scientists or something moving pretty close to it, at least people who are historians who want the truth and the facts to be told. People who have deliberately put themselves into positions across the country wherein they could influence the pages of history, see to it that the South gets a good shake-up, see to it that history is written so that we don't look so bad, or see to it that history is written for the sympathy of our cause. I mean, this doesn't happen as far as the Negro history is concerned. By and large, the Negro is mainly the black side of his history. And what he's getting today, if it contains any delusion, I would submit that it's very little by comparison to what we get as to history all along. Well, if you've been writing out of history the black man up to most recent times, and you can now condemn what the Negro is getting by way of black history because it contains delusions or a bit of padding or gives him a false sense of pride, I think this is absolutely absurd when the whole system of history before then carried with it the idea of cutting out the idea of anything could come out of black, you know.
Indeed, yeah.
I'd like to add this, though. I don't...
Gene, I'm going to cut this tape now and start another tape. This is the end of tape one of a conversation with Miss Lucy Thornton, Miss Jean Wheeler, Miss Isabel Blair, and Mr. Carmichael. Mr. Carmichael will not be present for the next tape. Continue on tape two.